wondering if you can describe for us just kind of what the city of Juarez is like, just the people and what it's like to be there. I don't even know if it's possible to separate it from the violence, but if you can just kind of describe for us what the city is like.
Well, first, thank you for having me, Jennifer. And the city of Juarez is really a very, in many ways, a very sort of bustling, dynamic. It's a city in a state of Mexico that has the same kind of reputation in Mexico that Texas has in the United States. You know, a lot of independent-minded people, people who have a real spirit about them, and also a state that's renowned for having a kind of an openness. So you can imagine what a contrast that is to the reality that the city has been living over the last 6 years or so, where the violence has completely eviscerated that culture in the sense of what it's like to be in the city, a city that's now governed by tremendous anxiety and fear, especially during the years that I cover in the book.
I guess now if you can describe for us what that city is like with this violence kind of overlaid onto the city that you were describing, what it was like for you to be there during your years of research while this was going on.
There's tremendous anxiety. I think paranoia is not too strong a word. This is a city in which everyone has been affected by the violence, Jennifer. There's no quarter where people feel immune from it. There's no sanctuary from it. People have been killed in rich neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods, in the dead of night, in the middle of the day, in front of shopping malls, in broad afternoon. So in front of schools, anywhere you go, there are people who've seen the violence. There are people who've been affected by the violence directly, immediately, regardless of their social class and regardless of where they live in the city. So that sense of anxiety and worry and paranoia and vulnerability especially is something that's palpable. You feel it everywhere, all the time.
So I have a question actually about language, because I'm tempted to say, you know, war on drugs. Some in Mexico will say, no, this is law enforcement activity. And there, different people use different phrases to describe the violence and frame the violence. What do we call it?
Well, I call it a war. And I think it is a war on drugs. But whatever it's a war on, there's no missing the fact that it's a war. I was chastised by the Attorney General's office early on in my research when I interviewed them and I asked them about the war on drugs and the Calderon policies. And I was immediately in a kind of a bristling way corrected that this was a law enforcement action. It wasn't a war. But in a city like Juarez, where the main where they disbanded the police and the main players were the army for many years, and then eventually the federal police took over. And where what you see is militarized convoys and the army stopping people in the streets and so on, it has all of the hallmarks of a war. And everybody on both sides of it at this point are armed with automatic weapons, and it has every bit the feel of a war zone.
Tell us, I guess, very much related to having the feel of a war zone. Tell us some numbers, if you can put some numbers on the number of people killed in Juarez during the time period that you're specifically focusing on.
This is one of the astounding things that I think many people have a difficult time wrapping their minds around. The war in Juarez actually started in January of 2008. And between January of 2008 and the end of 2012, over 11,000 people have been assassinated in the city of Juarez. This is a city of 1.3 million people. So that's an astounding number. And just as a reference point, consider the fact that in 10 years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, American fatalities have been less than that. They've been around 8,000. So in one city, in half the time, Mexico's losses in Juarez have exceeded what 10 years in two wars have cost American lives. So it's a very powerful index of the extent to which the city's been just eviscerated by the violence.
Well, let's back up a little bit then, and if you can kind of give us a brief history of how Juarez got this way, how we got to a situation where those numbers are true.
Juarez was historically a kind of a narco Garden of Eden, if you will. The Juarez cartel ran this city. It was at the time in the 90s, it was the most powerful cartel in all of Mexico. And all of the head capos of the Juarez cartel lived in Juarez. Their families were in Juarez. Juarez was actually a pretty safe city in the 90s. Several things happened, but the key thing is that when the U.S. starts interdicting the cocaine shipments coming out of Colombia into the eastern seaboard and eventually seal off Florida in the eastern seaboard as the main routes for cocaine into America, the Colombian cartel started using Mexico. And that means that they had to develop deeper relationships and alliances with the Mexican cartels. And eventually the Mexican cartels become so powerful that they take over the business, basically. They are the most important players in the and of course, they now manage not only cocaine, but methamphetamines, a lot of prescription drugs, heroin, as well as cocaine and marijuana. So that's how the Mexico becomes the centerpiece of this situation. But then one thing that sort of alters the position of Juarez is that when the leader of the Juarez cartel dies, he's replaced by his brother, Vicente Carrillo Fuentes, who ends up being a very sort of irascible, unstable, violent guy. And he starts violating the agreements that he has with the other cartels. Historically, if the Sinaloa cartel wanted to move its product through Juarez, they just paid the Juarez cartel a quota of a tax, and their shipments came through. They were even protected by the Juarez cartel. All of a sudden, there's tensions and conflicts between the cartels, and there's a moment in which the Sinaloa cartel feels that the situation is ripe for them to move into Juarez and take over the Juarez Plaza, as it's called, and take control of those access points into the U.S. And that's the beginning of the war, and that starts in 2008.
And, I mean, I think, you know, when you hear about a situation like this, an escalation in drugs, you think, well, law enforcement's going to come in and they're going to help with this. They're going to mitigate this. But in Juarez and in Mexico, that's a complicating factor. Explain the relationship between police, and I know there are police at different levels. There's federal, there's state, there's municipal. But if you can kind of explain the situation with police and the cartels.
So you have a situation in Mexico in 2007 when Felipe Calderón becomes president. And for whatever reason, he feels compelled to declare this war and stop the sort of the free reign that the cartels have had, especially in 6, 7, 8 states. At that point, one could make a reasonable argument that the state, the government of Mexico, had lost, for all intents and purposes, had lost control of these states. So Calderón launches this war against the cartels. The problem is he doesn't have any tools to wage this war. The federal police are 6,000-7,000 agents spread across the entire country. The only thing that he has is the Mexican army, which is about 250,000 soldiers. The state and municipal police forces in these particular states are completely owned by the cartels. In Chihuahua, for example, the municipal police in Juarez were literally the armed wing of the Juarez cartel. They were called La Línea, and they did all of the dirty work for the Juarez cartel. The state police were also under the control of the cartel. So there were no local law enforcement available to sort of ally with or to form a sort of joint venture to come in and try to deal with this. So what Calderón does is to send the army. The problem there is that the army is not prepared. They're not trained. They don't do law enforcement. What they do is they brute tactics, right? So they come in, they start seizing people, they start beating people up, they start, in some cases, torturing people. And so you have a kind of a chaotic mix. And so I think that's one of the problems with the strategy that Mexican government deployed. They were not really prepared. And I think, truly, they didn't anticipate what would come from this adventure.
I'm just thinking of, as you're describing the chaos and law enforcement and the army, ordinary citizens in Juarez, what do they do? I mean, for their own safety, how do they manage day to day?
This is one of the untold stories about the drug war in all of these communities. The people in these neighborhoods are absolutely vulnerable, and they have nowhere to turn. When local and state law enforcement are completely working at the behest of organized crime, and you've got death houses in neighborhoods, you've got places where the cartels' gangs are basically raining terror on communities and charging people, extorting small businesses, even little storefronts, and peddlers pushing their fruit juice carts. You have communities that have no recourse. In Juarez, if you called the Mexican version of 911, what you got was somebody that everybody knew was in the pay of the cartel. If you called the 911 number with any kind of information about the cartel, you were likely to turn up dead or at least be severely beaten or something. So there was no recourse for, and in many ways continues to be, because when the federal troops came in, initially there was a great enthusiasm and support. If you follow the polls in the local media, overwhelming support for the federal move into Juarez in 2008 and 2009. But the fact that they didn't succeed in bringing some sort of protection, the fact that they didn't succeed in reducing the violence, eventually means that they lose the war for hearts and minds. And the local populace at some point loses all faith in those efforts as well. So they're once again left with nowhere to turn.
All right. So what about the mayor? Left with nowhere to turn, is there anybody in city government who's going to help? What about the mayor?
Well, Sergio Díaz Ferriz is one of the key characters in the book. And I have to say that when I first met him, when I first came into Mexico to do this work, I assumed that Reyes Ferriz was made out of the same fabric of many Mexican politicians. And so I assumed this was probably a corrupt guy, probably a guy who was in the hands of the cartel. How else could he have been elected mayor? These were some of the questions that I had. And so for a number of months, I just observed him at public events before I had a chance to actually interview him. I must say that when I actually met him, but even in observing him working in public events, I started having the sense that, you know, this guy does not strike me as a narco. He has a certain nothing about him, in fact, would suggest that he would be a player in this kind of a situation. And of course, when he was elected, violence in Juarez had not yet erupted in this way. I asked everybody that I interviewed, people who loved the guy, people who hated the guy, what do you think about him? How is it that this guy got elected mayor? And I got a variety of responses, but never did I get a response that said he's in collusion with the Juarez cartel. What I got mostly was they let him be elected because they didn't need him. They controlled the police. They controlled everything else they needed to control. They didn't need to control the mayor. I heard that even from ex-Juarez cartel operatives. So I came to believe that, and in my own interactions with him, eventually I came to think that this guy was just a beleaguered man who found himself in a situation he had no idea he was going to be in, because when he was elected, the drug war was still months off, and it wasn't until months after he'd been elected that he was alerted by federal intelligence people that the war was coming to his city. So he's a very interesting guy, a guy with crosshairs on his back, a guy who the security to keep him alive was something to behold. It was something worthy of a U.S. president. I mean, the number of bodyguards, the armored trucks, it was just really something that caught me by surprise, frankly.
A little bit earlier, you were talking about sort of the strategy of trying to fight drugs in Mexico and the strategy of the war and, you know, trying to use the army, but they're not really trained for the task. So we've got kind of a mismatch there. Is there any part of strategy that you saw that did work? I mean, was there any part where anybody at any level of government did something that actually kind of made sense to try to bring down some of this violence and try to mitigate any of this?
Well, we have a situation in Juarez where in 2012, killings fell significantly to under 800 for the first time since 2007. So that's a good question. How did that happen? And as they say, there are many people who are authors of success, right, or who claim authorship of success. And what is the answer to that question? You'll find a lot of different people saying different things. One of the common things you hear is, well, what happened is that Sinaloa won. So that put an end to the war. It's also true, though, that during these years that the book covers, 2008 to 2010 in particular, and 11, the Mexican government took down a lot of people. Both Juarez and Sinaloa cartel operatives. So it's not that those strategies failed to end the violence in part because as these organizations fragmented, they went after each other in different ways. And also because what a lot of people don't realize is that a lot of the violence had to do not so much as cartel on cartel violence in the sense that you might think of it, but more in relation to their local gangs fighting for control of retail drug markets, which is a different kind of issue. So I think one could say that the law enforcement strategy did take down many cartel operatives. The third thing is that at the time of all this violence, Juarez in particular was under very dire economic circumstances. About 50% of the economy of the city is maquiladora-related, assembly plant-related. And those companies are producing things for American businesses. And as you know, we were in the grip here of a tremendous recession. And what people say in Mexico is when the U.S. catches a cold, Mexico catches pneumonia. It was sort of an example of that. So a lot of those assembly plants produce things for the U.S. auto industry. And we know that those companies were on the verge of collapse. So there was massive unemployment. There were businesses closing every single day. So that's another part of the possible contribution here, that you had the rebound in the American economy started absorbing some of the unemployment. That was another variable. And lastly, a variable that many people may be surprised about, because most people don't know this, that in 2010, in the spring of 2010, after a very tragic massacre of young people in Juarez, the Mexican government launched a program called Todos Somos Juarez, We Are All Juarez. And that program involved the infusion of $240 million into Juarez from programs that had to do with addictions, with school programs, with building new schools, creating universal health care in the city, with public spaces, with all kinds of things. The Mexican government's strategy had always, prior to that Todos Somos Juarez intervention in that city, had always been law enforcement and military stuff. They had never done anything to address the social fabric issues that helped create the sort of the context for a lot of this violence and produce the people who go and pick up, become involved with the cartels and so on. And so I think that's another part of the answer. So I think and also there was a massive cleanup of the police after multiple efforts eventually. So who knows where among those factors the answer lies, but I think it's some combination of those things.
What is Juarez's future? where is the city headed? You know, there are, as you're mentioning, some other factors coming into play, some different efforts that had been put into play. Look down the road a couple of years, a little bit, and what do you think?
This is a city full of really interesting, dynamic people. And it has always had a reputation for being a very vital place. And it's always attracted a lot of sort of adventurous people. A lot of people came to Juarez with an intent to cross that border and come into the United States. But it takes a certain kind of person to make that, to leave home and sort of play their lives that way. So I think one part of the answer to that is that there is a kind of a social capital in that city that's really impressive. And the people of Juarez are really fabulous. I love these people. The other thing is that I think there's a huge drop in the violence. That's changing the, you know, for the first time people are going out. You look at things like taxes, you know, that the city government is netting from sales at restaurants and liquor stores and stuff like that. It's clear that people are beginning to go out again. They're going to movie theaters. They're going, you know, so the, you know, 780 some odd assassinations in the city is still a lot of people killed. But for the people of Juarez, compared to what they had been living, which was sometimes 8 or 9 deaths a day, it feels like they're on vacation, you know. So I think there's a bright future for that city, and I think it'll continue to play a vital role in terms of Mexico's economy, in terms of the relationship between Mexico and the United States.
Thinking back to the years, especially that the book is concentrated on, and your travels and visits and interviews there, if there was a scene, a moment, an interview, or something that really, really struck you or really kind of encapsulated for you the story of Juarez during this time, in that, you know, in that moment or in that scene or in that interview, something that you would point to and say, ah, that really got Juarez in those years?
I would have to speak to the most poignant interviews I did with two of the parents whose children were massacred in Villas de Salvarca, a working-class neighborhood where all the families worked in the maquila, the assembly plants. But this neighborhood had been together since it was established. It's all sort of federally funded housing, but it was about 10 years old. And all these people lived together. It was as close to communal living as you get in Mexico. Everybody knew each other. And in a city where people were terrified of letting their children go out at night, one of these kids has his 18th year birthday party and has a party across the street. And everybody's relieved that the party's going to be right next door. And in the Juarez cartel, their main gang, it's called Los Aztecas. And Los Aztecas get word of this party and, through a series of miscommunications, think that it's actually a party related to Los Artistas Asesinos, which is the gang affiliated with the Sinaloa cartel. They show up in the middle of the night. A convoy of three vehicles, they all get out, they come in, they massacre 14 kids. These kids, in a city that has the highest dropout rates, school dropout rates of all of Mexico, most of these kids were in school. They were in high school, they were in college. And that moment was a tipping point in the awareness of all of Mexico. It sort of broke through the numbers. It broke through the sort of the numbing daily reports of horrendous violence. And that just tore the country apart. And so when I went to interview some of these parents, it really brought me close to the cost of this violence. And for the first time, I think, in a different way. I mean, here were good, innocent people whose lives were being absolutely destroyed by the violence and by the government's inability to stop the violence. And I left those interviews, which took place over a couple of days. Actually, some of them I came back and interviewed again. But I left there feeling transformed. I had never seen anything like that. You know, I was in the community. I was across the street from where it had happened. And I was in people's living rooms talking to them about their loss. And, you know, what could be a greater loss than losing a child? And some of these families had lost all of their children in that massacre. So I think that was the point, which was a kind of a tipping point for me personally. It was clearly a tipping point for the Mexican government and for the nation, because that's the incident that fast-tracked the social intervention of Todos Somos Juarez that made the government have to come in and put all this money into things that had to do not with the military, not with the police, but with the lives of ordinary people.
Ricardo Ainslie is the author of The Fight to Save Juarez, Life in the Heart of Mexico's Drug War. And Ricardo, we thank you for coming in and for sharing your stories with us.
Thank you, Jennifer. I really appreciate being here.